November 16th, 1982.
Oh, interesting. You know, I don't...
Modesty overcome.
Well, I... That's what my daughter tells me. Oh, Mom, you're always putting yourself down. I'm not putting myself down. I just realize I am background. I'm not the star. I'm the stage hand.
You viewed your role as supportive?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's. I mean, that was my role in life. I mean, everybody can't be a star. I'm beginning to realize that the stagehand has a lot to do with it, whether the star is a star or not. You know, it's, and I say that, well, with modesty. It's only in retrospect that you really see these things. I mean, you know, I knew I was enjoying life all the time. I was always having fun. I was always getting excited about something new that the children got into. I mean, you know, when they'd show an interest in something. And Bob, whenever he'd get involved in something, why, I read up on it and I listened, and, you know, and enjoyed it too. And I think that's the secret of happiness, you know.
Let's pick you up where we left off on the other tape, and that this was when Mr. Reeve and you left Chipman.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He brought me out of there and brought me over to Anchorage and dropped me off, went back to business in Valdez, and I was trying to think when that would be, because I know it was on the 4th of July that he came back over here. And I wasn't around. He went to the hotel where I was staying, and I wasn't in. And he went to the movie theater and had me paged, and I wasn't there. And so he went back to the hotel and went to bed. And I had gone up with a bunch. There were about five, maybe, of us that went up to Palmer. We'd never been to Palmer, and it was an all-day trip. I mean, at that time, you know, narrow, winding gravel road. I'd gone up there for the Palmer 4th of July celebration, and we didn't get back until about 2 o'clock in the morning, I think it was. And I walked into the hotel, and there's something about this, not intuition, but ESP or something, because for some reason or other, I went and looked at the register to see who had signed in, and there was Bob's name. So I went up to my room, and I lay there, and I thought, he's here. And in the morning, I got up early, and I went down and just sat in the lobby. And when he came down, he said, "Where have you been?"
He knew you were.
Well, he knew I was registered there, you know, and when he saw me in the lobby, he said, "Where have you been?" Because I hadn't been there the night before. And I told him I went up to Palmer for the 4th of July. And he said, "You better come home with me." He said, "We'll get married." Yes. So he took me back to Valdez, and it was about, well, we were married on the 22nd, so, we were all set. He was getting this Fairchild up in Fairbanks. He was going up there, and he had to drive up so he could fly it back. And he went with Dr. Wise, his good friend, in one car, and he arranged with me. There was a couple. He was one of the professors at the university. He and his wife had just come in on the boat and were driving up to Fairbanks, and so I was to ride with them. And a lot of amusing things happened. He and Doc Wise went right on through, but the car I was in, I can't think of his name. He was dean of the School of Mines, and I can't think of his name. But anyway, he and his wife, he was a geology professor. And so I spent 3 days getting to Fairbanks, because we had a flat tire out of just out of Black Rapids. And then we got into Black Rapids, and the spare went flat, too. Did the spare go flat? Or he didn't dare take a chance on going any further with no spare. That was it. And so we had to stay there on the trail phone, call ahead and for some truck driver that was coming south to bring a tire for his car. And so we spent 3 days in Black Rapids waiting to get to Fairbanks. In the meantime, Bob was wondering where in the heck I was, you know, because I hadn't shown up. And he was telling everybody, I'm getting married. Oh, who's the bride? Well, she isn't here yet, you know. So it got to the point where he was wondering, am I being stood up, you know? But anyway, I finally showed up, and so we got married the next day in the commissioner's office, which was interesting because about 2 years later, that commissioner was convicted of embezzlement. I said to Bob, do you suppose we should get married again? Maybe it isn't legal. He says, too late now. We already had a youngster. Everything. But,
did you ever have any aspirations to fly yourself?
Yes, I did. When I had gone out to San Francisco that time, you know, when I was there, I made up my mind I was going to take flying lessons so I'd be able to fly too. But instead, all my money went to saving up enough to buy a ticket back to Chittenden, and, you know, and
Irvine. What did Mr. Reed think about having you flying too?
He didn't know anything about it. I never told him that I intended to learn to fly.
Do you think he would have
encouraged? Well, once we were married, why, he wouldn't want me to. No, I was busy having babies and keeping the home fires burning and everything. So.
Did you ever want to see these places that he was taking off to?
I got to go every once in a while, you know, and there wasn't that much to see. I mean, you know,
You had been pretty adventuresome as an unmarried woman. Did you find mm-hmm. married life settled?
No, it was an adventure living in Valdez. I mean, you know, people used to say, we couldn't get good radio reception. It was terribly static. I mean, you know, lots of static. And, there was a movie once a week, and you know, in the old Eagle Hall, and a dance once a month at the Moose, and that sort of thing. But and they say, well, what do you do with all your time? It was just a matter of survival. I mean, you know, with the power off so much of the time, it was melting snow and baking your bread and doing your washing and just keeping a house going was it took all your time.
Did you tell me off tape that there was a generator in town that was turned on once?
It was a hydro plant across the bay, and when the lake would run dry, why, they couldn't run the plant. And so he, in the wintertime, it was normal to have onages instead of outages like we have now. The telephone operator would let everybody know the power is going to come on at 1 o'clock. It'll be on for 2 hours. He knew that was how much water he had in the lake that he could run the plant for 2 hours, and then he'd shut it off. So we'd get all our dough ready to raise and our laundry ready to wash and everything, and then when the power came on, why, we'd do the washing, we'd bake the bread, we'd fill a bathtub with water and, you know, just use the power while we had it, because we only had water when the power was on because we had our own individual pumps in our homes and wells, you know, and that was our water system.
When the generator was on, did you have hot water?
I was trying to think whether we... I think I must have had the boiler, probably had that filled with hot water on the oil heater. That was gravity fed, so we didn't need power for that.
Babies this time too.
Yes,
right?
Yes, and we didn't have disposable diapers. that's our biggest sewage problem now, is all the disposables. Everybody throws everything away. I raised 5 children on, I think it was 4, I may have added into 5 dozen Curie diapers, you know, because you washed them all the time and kept using them and using them and using them.
You just boiled your water, didn't you?
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, you had come from, like, city living, or at least modern living, mm-hmm. In Wisconsin. Did this rustic lifestyle affect you?
I was so excited, the fact that they had electricity at all. I thought I was going to a place, you know, with really primitive, you know, with none of those things, where you chopped your own wood and burned it and everything for heat and all that sort of thing. And to have running water and oil heat and all that, that to me was luxury to what I had anticipated, mm-hmm. not what I...
The interiors of the homes, I understand, were nice.
Oh, you fixed them up. That was another thing. You see, you were there a lot and you concentrated on having it comfortable and nice. I'll never forget when my... when Bob's dad came to visit that summer, the summer that Richard was born, that would be the year after we were married in 37, and about a month after he arrived on the boat, my mother came too.
Is this a permanent move that she made?
Well, she didn't anticipate it to be a permanent move. She came to see her first grandson. She, you know, didn't have any grandson. She had 2 granddaughters, but no grandson. And so we had fixed up the attic, but the second half story. It was a story and a half under the roof, into 2 rooms, one for Grandpa and one for Grandma, his father, my mother. And Mother told me afterwards, she said, you know, I asked Mr. Reeve, I said, what did you think when you, because we had written how we had a nice home now and, you know, all this and that. And she said, what did you think when Bob drove you down from the field and said, this is our house? And he said, I thought that shack, you know, is a home. And he said, but you know, the minute you walked in, why, it was a home. She said, well, that was my first impression, too. I mean, you know, it was just, well, it looked like a shack on the outside, but inside we had it all lined with Sellotex, you know, and comfortable furniture. And
the Anchorage, some of the Anchorage women tell me that they would import from outside all the modern conveniences of the time. They had probably more electricity than you did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we had...
The interiors looked as good as a home in Seattle.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you agree with that, or was it still rustic inside?
No, it was finished. You know, it was complete. When the military families first came back after the Second World War, the Dunkels have a big mine. They had the Independence Mine and the Lucky Shot and those mines, and then they had their little house in town, which was a tar paper shack. And one of the general's wives said, you know, Mrs. Dunkel had some of us over for tea, and she said, when we drove up in front of that tar paper shack, we all thought, oh, how casual these people are. And she said, then we walked in and she said there wasn't a nicer tea on nicer china in more comfortable surroundings than that afternoon. But she said, as we drove up, we just couldn't understand, why didn't they fix it up? They could have cared less what it looked like. It was what they had that was important.
Can we say that the role of a married woman then was to create this comfort?
With home. Yes.
In the
homemaking. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was a full-time job.
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm.
What about the women in Valdez when you were a young married woman? Was there get-togethers?
Yes, they had what they called the Tillicum Club. It was and once a month we had card parties, mostly bridge, some pinochle, And there would be like 40, no, this was couples would have these evening card parties once a month. And then the churches would have their bazaars and, you know, it was...
Women ever get together and by themselves?
Yes, we had the Eastern Star. The Masons and the Eastern Star were organized. I mean, you know, they were a small group, but they went through all the rigmarole and had their, and raised funds for the children's hospitals. And I mean, you know, it was... they were... No, not in Valdez. In Anchorage, yes. Mm-hmm. When I moved here, the Anchorage Women's Club was very active.
And your, when you had your children, did you go to a clinic or a hospital?
Well, in Valdez, there was no hospital there, and I went over to Seward on the boat. That was the closest hospital. Bob wouldn't fly me because he was afraid of having a forced landing and having to officiate at a birth. But I went over on the boat for both my first two youngsters and then came back on the boat with the new baby.
So you had to find that very well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, I almost missed it with Richard, the first one, because he came a little early. And I went to be there 2 weeks or 10 days before his birth and got all settled in a little apartment that the doctor had arranged for us to have, and went across the street to the grocery store and stocked up on canned soup and, you know, that sort of thing. And that night at midnight, why I started having labor, and when I called him, he said, you're early. He said, I better come over and check. And he said, when he did get there, he said, get right up to the hospital. But the second one, Roberta, was on time, and I was there. It was about 10 days before.
In connection with the first birth, did you have any kind of information about what you'd be going through?
No, just...
Had you ever...
I just took things as they came.
Did you have women friends that told you about their birth?
No, there was only one other woman in Valdez that had little children. You know, the others were all older women whose children were grown and gone, and you just didn't talk about those things then.
The older women didn't give you any advice?
No. The one that I had, I didn't have any sewing machine, and I had to have some maternity clothes when I outgrew what I had, and Mrs. Ecomo, I remember, and so she, one time when she was sitting me around the middle, she said, oh my, she said, your baby has dropped. I didn't know what that meant. And she said, you'd better get over at the hospital. And I said, well, I'm going next week. She said, I think you should go now. She said, because after it drops, why, then it could be any time within a couple of weeks. And I said, well, that still gives me time. And she said, I think you should go now. So instead of taking next week's boat, I took that week's boat. And I got there, you know, the same night was when I had...
She was right.
It was 12 hours a trip on the boat.
That was your first one?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So she was right.
Yeah. Yes, uh-huh. She had had four, I think, children, and she knew that when it had dropped, it was time to be close to help.
Well, when you say in those days women didn't discuss things...
No, they didn't...
There was no discussion of what we would consider
intimate. No, there weren't any groups or you know, seminars or classes or anything.
Well,
but
close women friends, did they just
No.
Problems they were having with their husband or childbirth problems or sexual.
No, not in a small town like that.
You were close woman friends.
Well, none of us were that close. We didn't have a cup of coffee in the morning together. We were all busy, each in our own homes. In fact, I remember one morning after I had Richard at home, the new baby and everything, and one of the older women came down to see me. I know it was to see that I was getting along all right, but at the time I resented it so, because here she was, I was in the midst of sterilizing bottles and washing diapers and tired from not having slept, you know, having given the 2 o'clock feeding and all that sort of thing. And I resented the fact that she came in. In retrospect, again, why I realized that they were interested in whether I needed help, you know.
If you had a problem pertaining to something women do, let's see, a problem with your child or your pregnancy, and you just wanted some advice, pretty much on your own?
I don't think I ever sought advice. It was trial and error, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only one I ever called on was the doctor when Richard had...
And he didn't tell you ahead of time what you would be experiencing?
Well, he wasn't there at the time I went to the hospital. He'd gone out on a trip for a couple of months. He was a doctor and dentist.
In retrospect, do you have any suggestions about this kind of, with your own daughters, were you more candid with them about what they'd be experiencing? Or do you think it's important nowadays there's so much...
They have all that available to them, you know, it's... like Roberta was up in Talkeetna, you know, and she was going to be having her first one, and she was... trundling around up there, slipping on the ice, gathering her eggs, the chickens she had out back, and that sort of thing. And then, let's see, did Don fly her? Yes, Don flew her down to stay with me and when it was time. And, yeah, it was Bob's birthday on the 27th. And little Holly was born on the 28th. But, I mean, Roberta went to the hospital. And that was the, let's see now, how was it? I had my mother to take care of. I couldn't leave the house. Bob wasn't here. He was on a trip. And so my other daughter drove her out to the hospital. And then we called Don, and he came down the next morning. So she was alone, too, just like I was, you know, having her baby. But with all the conveniences, you know, I mean, hospital services and all that sort of thing. The second one, she came down, she drove herself down and came here, and she said, I don't think I'll bother to undress. And she lay down on the couch, and I said, well, now if you need me, just call. And by golly, I woke up in the morning and the couch was empty and her car was gone. She'd driven herself out to the hospital. She was independent spirit too.
Well, do you think had you had more information, it would have made things easier, or do you think it's...
No. You go through it alone anyway, and I'd always been healthy, you know, and of course, if something had gone wrong, why, it would have been tragic, but I was, it, nothing did.
Were there women in Valdez that were having the babies?
No, there was just that one family, I remember, Signe Thomas, and she had five youngsters, and she was busy and over on the other side of town, and we just didn't have any.
Well, I know you moved your young family to Fairbanks in 4 years' time?
Yes, 41. 41. We moved up there in the Fairchild. We had the my mother.
So your mother now has moved.
When she came that summer, when Richard was born, she came for a couple of months, and she didn't go out to the States for 6 years. She just liked it. She just settled in, and so we had my mother and Richard, and Roberta was a baby, 8 months old, and the clothes basket full of bedding and dishes and things like that. And let's see, did we take the... Anyway, and a cat. The plane was just absolutely crowded. And it was in January. And it was, I think, about maybe zero in Valdez. And when we landed in Fairbanks, it was 37 below. Bob had, he was so proud of this heater he had put in his airplane. Well, here we were all just stuffed in there and blankets over us and everything, and that heater blowing heat in, we nearly suffocated. I mean, you know, the cat yowling in the back. Richard on my lap, and or Roberta on my lap, and Richard on Mother's lap. I mean, you know, just
that was that. What was the cause for you to move to Fairmont?
There was nothing else to do in Valdez. He had gone through this terrible situation in 39 when the Civil Aeronautics Administration came up here and regulated everybody and gave them roots. And it was all, that's another long thing, when they had this hearing, then the examiner's report came back with the recommendations of the examiner that this area should go to so-and-so and that area to so-and-so.
This included everything. All the bush pilots.
Yes, yes, that's all there were here then. And it was establishing areas for them, and they allotted Valdez to Copper Center, or Copper Center for Bob. It was all based on what planes they had and where they had flown during the last 6 months. I mean, this is bureaucracy for you, you know. And at that time was when Bob's airplane had blown over and upside down on the field, and he was rebuilding it, and so he hadn't been flying, you know, and so he got allotted this one place that nobody else was interested in, and he did that. No, there was absolutely no business there, and the only business there would be emergencies that he wouldn't get paid for. I mean, you know, so he'd still have his gas bill to pay, but he wouldn't have any income. So he, in defiance of the regulations, that was one thing that worked throughout his life. He told me one time, he said, you know, an airplane is designed to use the opposing forces. You know, when the wind is blowing this way, you fly this way, that gives you lift, and, you know, he didn't go into all the technical details. All he had to do was make that statement. An airplane is designed to use the opposing forces. And that's what he was. He was designed like an airplane. Anything that was opposing, he went right straight into. And that's where his success came from.
What was in Fairbanks for him?
Well, that came up in the film that they showed at the Historical Society. Noel Wien said that Noel had a contract up to Windy Creek. I suppose it was or Dry Creek rather, a mine of some kind to fly in 10,000 pounds of goods and supplies or whatever. And he only had one airplane operating, and so he asked Bob to help him out on that contract. That's what Bob got started on. Then he got other contracts. That was when he put the window in the bottom of his plane, and he got these surveying contracts for these fields and things like that. And he got, and he'd have some trappers ask him to take them out to the, it was just touch and go all the time. So then then we had the big contract down at Nabesna. That was the whole summer of 41. But then in that winter, it got real sparse again. The contract was completed. And then he got the, that was when he got the contract for the aerial surveying and moved us down here because he was based out of here to do that. And then it was after we got here, he got the contract, Anchorage, right here in this house. He got the contract with the ACS. And that was all during the war. He was flying down the Aleutians in his...
Now that we have you in Anchorage in 42.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The beginning of the war for the United States.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you recall what life was like for the civilians?
Yes. We had blackout situations. I mean, you know, we had to have our windows coverable and that sort of thing. I remember... there was a shortage. We were never rationed on anything, but there was a shortage of things. For instance, there was no gum in the stores, and so when Bob would go down the Aleutians to these military camps, forts, why the fellows there would give him a carton of gum, and that was a luxury. I mean, that was something, and it was doled out one piece at a time, not one package at a time.
Were you fearful after the bombing
of Dutch Harbor? Not for Anchorage, I wasn't fearful. I was only fearful for Bob flying down into the combat zone. You know, he came home one day and he had this pistol that he was cleaning up and fixing his ammunition for and putting that in his, what do they call it, survival kit, emergency equipment in the airplane, which they always had all the time. But this is the first time he'd ever had a pistol in there, and he showed me, he said, look at what I got out of the field, because I'm going into a combat zone. And it was an identification card, and he was a captain in military, you know, in case you were captured. And that was when I started, not to worry, but to be concerned, I mean, you know, hoping everything would go all right. And
how did you deal with your feelings of apprehension for him?
I probably, yes. And out there. For the ACS, the Alaska Communication System, it was our Western Union, so to speak. It was the military communication system. And they, at the time, they were building these fields, like at Cold Bay and Umnak and Amchitka and, you know, all of, along. And the ACS had such a low priority. They were shipping in the supplies for the people building these fields. You know, they were more important than communications equipment as such. And their priority was so low that they went out and made a contract with a civilian operator to get their things down. You see, everything was on a space available basis, and the DC-3s that were the troop carriers at the time were busy with people. I mean, they were overloaded all the time anyway. And so the ACS just made a contract with him to do nothing but fly his, I mean, their needs down there. And so he'd get down there and get stuck with weather, you know.
And you had no information on
that? No, until he went down. And then they called me and let me know that Bob had to ditch in the ocean now, out of Cold Bay, and but he was all right. I mean, that was all. I mean, I didn't know anything else about it except that he'd gone down. And I said, I wish you hadn't told me anything. I would have just, as long as he is all right, I said, I wish you hadn't told me anything, because now I have worry. How is he going to get back and all this and that? Well, they brought him in. That was the old Boeing ADA that he had to ditch. And
was there ever any discussion of you and the children leaving?
No.
Several women have told me that Jim had been encouraged to leave Alaska.
Oh, they were. All the women were. The gal that does my hair was a young hairdresser at the time, and they wanted her to leave. And she said, heck no. She said, there are going to be secretaries out there at the base and shopkeepers here that are going to need their hair done. She said, I'm not going to leave, you know, just because of the
Alaska residents had a choice.
Yes, they did. The military had to leave. I mean, their families were evacuated, yes. That's how we happened to have this house. This group of houses in this two-block area on both sides of the alley, a bunch of this was before the families had to be evacuated. The a bunch of officers got together and got a FHA loans, and they put up these houses. And there were no construction workers. They used GIs off duty out there to put these four-room houses together, and they all lived in this area. And that was in December of 41 that these houses were built. They just bulldozed the whole thing off. It was just a gravel bed with these houses standing on, all in order, each with their own cesspool and, you know, all that. Then in 42, after Dutch Harbor was bombed in June of 42, why, they had to evacuate all those families that lived here, so the local people bought them up. And one of them was Z.J. Lusak. They called him Doc. He was a pharmacist and had the drugstore. And he bought up five of them. So when we were going to move down here, why, Bob went to him and, rented this one of his houses. And so we paid rent for about, 2 years. And then there was no place else to go or anything. Anyway, ZJ decided that he wanted to sell those houses. And didn't I tell you about this?
Mm-hmm.
About what it cost? I mean, it's already on...
I don't think we did that on
YouTube. Oh, Well, anyway, this four-room house, we had, whoever was living in them had first option to buy. And so Bob said, how much do you want for it? And he said, $10,000. And he said, now, ZJ, I know darn well you only paid $5,000 for it. He said, you're not going to make... you're not going to double the price on it for me, are you? And ZJ said, they always... everything was gambling, a fun sort of gambling thing. And so he said, tell you what, he said, you call this coin, and if you call it, he said, I'll give you 12, but if you don't call it, I'll only pay you 8. ZJ said, fine, you know, it didn't make any difference to him. He was going to make a profit anyway. So it came up tails, and ZJ said heads, so we paid $8,000 for it.
You were telling me, too, that the Lynn, about the Lend-Lease, where the Russian planes would come in.
Yes, mm-hmm.
And what was Mr. Reed? Was Mr. Reed involved in that?
No. At that time, he was flying down the Aleutians. They were going... see, these 41 was when they were building the fields, and then it was 43 that they started coming through using the fields for the Russians, but we were living here, and he was flying down the Aleutians then for the ACS.
And the Russians.
And Cole Bay was the staging point for ships with Lend-Lease stuff. The Russians would we'd bring shiploads of lumber and that sort of thing. So the only way he was even saw any of them was in Cole Bay, and they kept to themselves very much down there.
And you
there.
Didn't see them
in Anchorage? No, they weren't in Anchorage.
Well, did you have a community of women in Anchorage during this time that you support?
You mean...
Your family. I'm thinking that now that your husband is out in the Aleutians and you have these small children. Did you know very many people in Anchorage?
Yes. We'd go to PTA meetings and the Anchorage Women's Club and...
But other pilots, wives, did you...
Everybody pretty much tended to their own business. Yeah, I
Your mother was with me at the time.
Yes, yeah, she was here. I'm trying to think of those years for until. You see, the next big change was when the war ended, and then Bob bought DC-3s and started to hire pilots. I mean, you know, otherwise he was gone all the time. When he was gone, I was so busy getting everything ready for him when he came home, so that everything would be set and we could do things. Or I was just busy with the youngsters, you know, and all their school activities, and going up to see the ice skating on 9th and C, and you know, it was just youngsters and me and their friends, and you know.
Perhaps I got the idea because you said that living around you were several around this house here.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Several pilot families.
Yes, well, that was after the war that the Borlands moved in down here. You see, 40s, the war ended in 40s. 45, fall of 45, yeah. 46 was when, well, that was a pile, and the Underhills, yeah, they were here all the time, but,
not any support for you,
no, oh no, uh-uh, for none of us, we were
on your
independent,
own.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to remember details about.
What about the fabric of the town of Anchorage? Let's say during the war and after. How did it change? Very obviously, people tell me the whole style of life in Alaska changed during World War II. Would you agree with that?
Not during the war. No, immediately following. Yes. Well, of course, during the war, all the young soldiers were out here, and they would come into town on leave, and there were places that were off limits for them, and that sort of thing. But we didn't, well, Bob and I had contact with them out there, the officers, because he was dealing with the military, and for instance, like on Thanksgiving, they were all temporary bachelors at the time, you know, no families, and they lived in these quarters, like four officers to a quarters, and they would have friends, lady friends, cook a Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, they were the hosts, and we had a party in their quarters, you know, that sort of thing. And I remember Bob's birthday was the same as the commanding general, Davenport Johnson, out here at the base. And he went out to a big bachelor party for his and Davenport's birthday, you know, that sort of thing. But the town life, it was schools, you know, we all had young children, and it was schools and the Elks Club was the social.
Well, did you think that this sense of frontier life was being penetrated or was changing, becoming more modern after the war, let's say?
Oh, yes, after the war. They got organized. I mean, you know, well, the new people coming in did that. Well, and of course, our children were growing up then, and it was. I'm talking about my generation, so to speak. We always had like the Chamber of Commerce invited the military in. Yeah, sliding. And that was when it was established a real good rapport between the military and the town, which has just continued on, you know, through all the years, even after we got.
It's a space
dumb and sophisticated. And, oh, yeah. Well, that was when I was in politics. See, I was elected national committee. And, well, I'll tell you how I got into that. Bob, in 52, was when it was time for election, and Bob Bartlett, who was a Democrat, and of course, we were both of us dyed-in-the-wool Republican. I just grew up with that when my dad was a Republican. And Bob's whole philosophy of government was Republican, too. And we never had any arguments on that. We both worked hard. And, by the way, Bob was always very patriotic, too. I mean, he was just, well, he went away and joined the Army, you know, enlisted instead of being drafted and all that sort of thing. He just had a great love of country. And so the Republican Party wasn't really organized, but there was a group, you know, that to find candidates to run for office. And as a territory, why, all we had was a non-voting delegate to the House of Representatives. And some people came to him knowing his strong Republican leanings and everything and asked him to run. At that time, things were sort of leveling off in the business. He was no longer flying. He had his office under control. He had acquired a good gal that set up the accounting system for the airline to meet all the CAB regulations and all that sort of thing. And so he, well, that's something new and different. His shooting a world record brown bear had worn off the excitement of that, you know. And so he decided, yes, he'd run. Well, he was a real renegade in politics in that he refused to accept any financial contributions of any kind, because then he'd say, well, and I'd owe them something, and he said, when I get in there, I'm going to do it my way. He was always a my way type of person. And of course, I was president of the Republican Women's Club at the time, and so I went out with campaign posters, drove the highway, and put them in the roadhouses, we call them, men, their lodges now. And we'd go down to Seward and get talking. I went around to all the Republican Women's Clubs throughout the state, and, you know, just Republican as opposed to Democrat. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, that, now, see, you're of the new generation, aren't you? Yes, definitely. Republicans were, now,
from our live archives, that's a flock
for tariff and incoming goods,
GRKN.
States' rights, as opposed to a big federal government. Republicans were for individual areas to govern themselves. Yes. It was a Republican delegate that first brought up the fact that we should have statehood here. But as a party, yes, they were for statehood. But Bob and I individually, and a lot of us, were against it. We didn't think we were ready for it yet. I mean, you know, that we didn't have any people politically minded enough, you know, to work in the system we all wanted to be individualists and independent of bureaucracy. And we knew that once we got a state government, then that was just another layer of bureaucracy. We already had the feds to fight. I was, yes, mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. Just because of, to get back to his running for delegate, went through all this series of promotion and campaigning and everything, and he lost by about 2,000 votes. I mean, you know, I was just going through the papers back there, and I had saved all the newspapers during that campaign. And one headline says, late votes show Bartlett lessening Reeves surprising, not victory, lead. And it wasn't until all the Bush votes came in at that time, or rural votes, I don't know, I thought it was, except that that's the term they use now, but Bartlett did go ahead. The first return, Bob was leading, and then it ended up with Bartlett getting it. And I thought, well, if the best man couldn't win, that means that we have to do a lot of work around here. And so when it came time for 56, but at that time we were elected in convention. Yeah. And so I, one of the women who wanted to be National Committee Woman, but you know, we weren't elected in convention. We were elected on the ballot at that time. We had a closed ballot, a closed primary. You had to register as either a Republican or Democrat to get a ticket, you know, and a ballot. And she urged me to run for National Committee Woman. Well, at that time, my youngest child was 8 or 9, you would have been. And I needed something else to do. I mean, something not full-time, but an interest, I think. Well, it's to organize the party throughout the state, territory then. And then you attend the meetings, and then they, you meet a quota for National, so that National can distribute funds and send speakers out during the next campaign, next election, and all that sort of thing. And that's what I did. In fact, I wrote to the National Committee and asked the duties of a committee woman, you know, in order to know what I was getting into. And it was organizing the party. So I, when Bob was campaigning in 52, I'd gone with him to all these different places. I didn't tag along all over, but I would go and talk to the women and that sort of thing. Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, Juneau, Sitka, Fairbanks, Nome, you know, just all over. I'd gotten acquainted with people. So then I, as National Committee Woman, I went to these various communities and got them organized into women's clubs. And I forget, in Petersburg, they didn't have enough women, and they said, could we have the men join? They didn't have a Republican club as such, and so I said, why not? I said, that's a good idea, you know, and so that many more people were. It was a way of getting them organized. It was a way of educating them, you know, as to what the party stood for and that sort of thing. No, I didn't, because as the representative, you know, as the committee woman, I had to go along with what the party was for. I could personally on the side say, no, I don't think it's good, and I told my kids, you know, and that sort of thing. But officially, I went back with the committee that went back to Washington, and they assigned me Fred Seaton as the Secretary of the Interior, and that's what we were under at the time of the territory. And these other men that were on the committee were assigned to talk to senators from other states to convince them we should have statehood. But they assigned me to thank the senators who were already on our side. You know, that was because I couldn't convincingly talk to a senator who didn't know anything about it or was opposed, you know. So that was to thank those that were already on our side. I just knew I wouldn't be convincing. Well, and they knew that I was personally opposed to it. So they didn't ask me to take on Senator so-and-so, you know. I said, no, it was because of my, I would go and visit with them, so that then they would talk to another senator to convince him of that. I still think we weren't ready for it, look out. Oh, I can't say I'm disappointed. I would have, if it had gone my way, we would have approached it more, not cautiously, more comprehensively or something. You know, we would have been geared for it. The thing that bothered us, the Democrats were the only ones. I'm really strongly partisan. Were the kind that were for giving people things. And, you know, see, Franklin D. Roosevelt to me is the worst enemy the country ever had. You know, it just because of his way of doing things.
Boston.
And that philosophy of government was so opposed to my idea of what it should be. And in the state of Alaska, the Republicans were all people who were enterprising individualists that would be stifled by bureaucracy. And they didn't have, they were so busy building things that they didn't have time to run for office or to serve on a in a legislature or anything like that.
And Alpine this winter, and the Great Alaskan Sound Company is making it easier than ever with its first ever factory.
Oh yes. Oh yes. Uh-huh. Oh yes. Mm-hmm. Well, their men were busy with whatever their industry or business or whatever it was, and they were the ones that got out the vote and all of that. You know, the League of Women Voters grew into a big. A few. They were scattered, but like Irene Ryan and Helen Fisher and you know. Whose children were grown and that sort of thing. Yes, there was a great deal of interest in them. In fact, I'll never forget when my sister and her husband were visiting me to live on the East Coast. And
buy it for yourself.
The soft water man came in the back door and I said, this is Mr. Thomas, you know, my sister and her husband. And I said, and he's a good Republican too. And my sister sat back and she said, you know, I hear this all over. She said, you know, back home, it's, they'll say, well, he's a Jew, or he's a Puerto Rican, or he's a Catholic, you know, that's a, because it up here, it's either he's a Republican or he's a Democrat. You know, we were very politics conscious.
The purchase of any classical Western
yes.
Yes. Dean Hammer Tuck Minor Applause. You'll receive a free guitar case valued from $90 to $160. They've also got 15 select electric guitars and cases, normally priced from $253 to $324. Your choice now just $189. You can't beat these prices or quality. It's all happening at L&G Music during their 33rd birthday celebration on the corner of 5th and B Street downtown.
Tonight on the mini concert, Mr. Rock and Roll himself, Rick Derringer. That comes up at 9 o'clock this evening.
Only regret is I didn't come sooner.
No.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, and I found my man here, Maria. You know, as you say, hindsight, when I see that my mother married, you know, he was a man she loved, I mean, you know, and all that, but I think how dull, you know, it would have been just to stay in Wisconsin. The only excitement she had in her life is when she followed me up here and got to live in Alaska. You know, she just loved it. She'd go out for a trip and couldn't wait to get back again. And, oh, now this brings me to a point I wanted to make. I even wrote myself a little note. And the word is freedom. I didn't know until about 3 years ago, I think it was, one of the military wives knew out here, and this is, say, 1980, and she said that, you know, why did you like it so well here? I mean, you know, what made you fall in love with Alaska? And I said, well, it was the freedom we had. And she said, yes. I mean, she doesn't see any more freedom here on this base than she did out in Texas or wherever. And it kind of bothered me, you know, just the way she looked at me. And I thought to myself, what am I saying? And I was lying in bed that night, and I thought, freedom from what? You know, what did I mean? And then it dawned on me. It was freedom from social amenities. You know, where in the States, you had to do things the way other people did them. And up here, there were no, the only rule were the Ten Commandments. You know, you were back to doing what you chose to do. You would dress up when you went to the Moose Hall to the dance by your own choice. You could have, some people did. If they were just in off the trail, they came in their trail gear, you know, and everybody had just as good a time. You didn't have to wash on Monday, iron on Tuesday, mend on Wednesday, whatever. Thursday was the day for the church sewing circle. Friday was the day to, this was my mother's routine, our life back then, even when I was working. That was what she did, you know, because everybody else did it. And here, I remember when my mother first came and she said, oh, she said, aren't you going to wash today? And I said, no, I got that taken care of yesterday. Or, I'll wait until Bob gets home and I can put his underwear in with it. Or, on a Sunday I'd say, well, I better get washed up, get the washing done because Bob's going to be leaving again in the morning or something like that. She couldn't understand, you know, and she loved that freedom. Nowadays we call it stress and pressure, you know, of having to do certain things at certain times. But, which reminds me of how funny it was, he's putting the wash on the line. Bob slept raw, and so there would never be any pajamas in the line. So I would take, I had a pair of pajamas that I would put through the rinse water and hang on the line. When you put it on the line, you see, everything had to hang out on the line. And if they went by, you didn't see any pajamas. that was, you see, I still hadn't realized all my freedoms.